You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Whether you need a battery for your truck or batteries for your trail cameras, Interstate Batteries has the batteries for your everyday life. Stop into a local retail location. They have thousands upon thousands of them all over the United States. Or go and visit interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
The Southern Ground Hunting Podcast is brought to you by Spartan Forge. It's forged in combat and tailored for hunters. Spartan Forge stands at the nexus of machine learning and whitetail deer hunting to deliver truly intuitive and science-based products that save the hunter time spent scouting, planning, and executing their hunts. You can start your free 14-day trial today by visiting spartanforge.ai, and you can use the code SOUTHERNGROUND, that's all lowercase, all one word, SOUTHERNGROUND at checkout, and that'll get you 25% off of your purchase. If you're wanting to know more about saddle hunting, well, check out tetherednation.com for all your saddle hunting needs. Tethered is for saddle hunters by saddle hunters, and they're redefining ultralight hunting. If you'd like to support the Southern Ground Hunting Podcast, you can visit patreon.com/southernground hunting, or you can click on the link in the show notes of this podcast episode. We offer two different tiers for our patrons that offer a solid list of benefits. We'd love for you to join the Southern Ground Hunting community today. Again, that's patreon.com/southernground hunting. And now let's get to the show. All right, on the line with us today, we've got Mr. Reese Johnson, a return guest from the great state, the bluegrass state of Kentucky. Reese, how's it going up there in bourbon country?
Today, it's actually not too bad.
It's been pretty hot.
Got some better weather this week, and trying to take advantage of it.
Heck yeah. I don't blame you, man. We had a good, nice little cool front that's come through the last couple days. And I've been stuck at home working. So,
Well, we went on vacation last week, made the wife happy, the kids happy. And I told myself that's been my deadline in my head when I get back, it's deer time.
Well, yeah, about that time where a lot of the deer are starting to show, you know, what they're going to be and, whether or not they're going to be worth hunting this season. I know for you, that's a big, huge, this time of year is pretty giant, right? Like trying to figure out target deer and things like that.
Which history means more to me than I think anything, you know, building that with 1, 2, 3 deer, you know, that I might target this year. That's the whole chess match. That's what gets me fired up. And that's what I go into. So, I'm getting back into those patterns that I learned in years past, trying to plan on tracking those deer as they, you know, of course, before the shift, you know, making sure they're there doing their summer thing, and then how I'm going to hunt them in September, October, and then, you know, hopefully not that long if I can get them on the ground, but we'll figure that out then.
So last year we talked to you, I guess it was around this time. It may have been a little bit later in July or so when we talked to you last year, but we talked about targeting specific deer, and I know you were targeting several specific deer this past season, and we discussed your trail camera strategy. But just for people who haven't heard that, and if you're listening to this and you haven't heard that episode, go back and check that out from last summer. It's with Reese Johnson. Actually, Reese, I don't know if I've told you, but that's been one of the more popular episodes that we've done. I think a lot of people are really interested in the trail camera stuff. But do just a quick like recap of kind of your trail camera strategy going into the summertime and then early August and September.
Sure. So I run roughly 100 cameras. Those are scattered in 3 states. Many of those on public land, many of those on private land. I just enjoy it. That's just what gets me. You never know. And every chance I get, I'm going to try to, you know, snag another camera, add another camera. And, you know, it's just turned into, well, and I have got some, you know, friends, we share pictures and hunt together and that has helped, but roughly that's kind of where we're sitting at going into 2021. And so, private land and where it's allowed on some public land. This time of year, I'm on salt. I mean, any kind of mineral lick that I can, if you can get through that to the, at this time of year, there's nothing better. You can save on cameras as far as spacing goes, in my opinion, because those bucks are generally going to hit those if they're, well, if they're established to the point where they're, you know, they've been using that for years. You know, at the, we have one farm we've hunted for over 10 years, and those licks are, you know, they're 6-8 feet across. And, you know, I typically put about 100 pounds, give or take, of salt. A lot of people ask me what we use. And for those that, that want to know, it's Redmond salt, which is actually, it's a livestock brand, or it's not brand, but it's a livestock bag, but it actually comes from the same mine as Trophy Rock. So it's, so the contents are exactly the same as Trophy Rock, but it's crushed in the form of salt rather than a block or a rock, and it's marketed towards livestock versus hunters. So you're getting crushed 50-pound bags for a third, or let's say a half of the price of one single rock that's 20 pounds.
Huh.
So money-wise, way better if you could, but it's a little more difficult to find. But if you can find it either from your local co-op, order that or not, that is what I like. And then Purina Antler Max, not the supplement, but the actual mineral, there's a difference. And then I run the Redmond's 2-to-1 ratio with the Purina, because the Purina is quite a bit more expensive. But that has seemed to work well for me. I like to target clay soils more so than anything. That seems to be what works. Typically take a shovel, you know, rake away all the debris when I'm starting a new one. I don't usually use stumps very often. The only thing that will get me that has cost me a few licks is if you can, if there's no drain, if you don't set it up to where it will run off and you get that water, that stagnant water sitting in there, that will kill it. But if you can go in there and have a somewhat of a runoff, or at least create a diversion channel or where that water will drain out, those licks seem to do the best. And that, if you get in that kind of organic type, and it's really funny in to watch the deer, because I have seen certain licks where they just will not touch it. And I, one of them in specific, I put 300 or 400 pounds on it just to try to see. I was like, I'm going to see if a certain amount of salt will change what they do. And no matter how much I put to it, and it was actually on my, where I lived at, I lived on 5 acres previously. And I tried it, and I kept, and because it was easy, I kept putting, kept putting, kept putting, never would take, never would take. And then other spots, I can put out one bag and they will just, you know, dig a hole the size of a truck hood. So interesting to see that camera wise. Summertime is just too easy. It's too convenient. Like I said, you can be way more efficient with your cameras in the summertime, which allows me to use my spare cameras in the summertime to do interesting and neat setups with them. And those are some of the, you know, the fun I like to have this time of year.
Yeah.
When it comes to that.
So, I know talking to some friends in Tennessee, I've hunted Tennessee quite a bit. It is in a lot of places, legal in Tennessee to use mineral, on public land. And I believe, don't mark my word on this, but I believe you can actually hunt over a mineral site in Tennessee on public land.
That, I don't mean to cut you off there, that, no, you know, to me, that to me, I wouldn't hunt over any of my mineral licks, not mm-hmm. likely. I mean, maybe if you were in a state like Kentucky, September 3rd, where you go in there and hunt, but traditionally from all the years of running pictures, cameras on salt licks, it just does not seem. Now, if you were feeding at the same location and doubling your, that might be, or if it was on the potential on the edge of a field where they're coming to feed, but I usually do not hunt that time of year. Most of the properties I'm allowed to hunt do not have the opportunity for early season velvet, and I typically like to go west during those first 2 weeks of September anyway, if I can. That's my getaway, so I can be back here for the rut. Mm-hmm. That is what I'm shooting for. And then I'll go into on places that do not allow it, because there are a couple states where it's not possible. I will target scrapes. I mean, you know, those are spots that I will traditionally, you know, I spend a lot of time in the woods postseason scouting. To me, I haven't stepped foot in the woods, you know, since turkey season, of course, but that was for a different reason. But, you know, I shed hunted, which last year was down year for me, picked up a little over 50, but the you know, the year before I picked up over 100. And so
does that go into your where you're picking up these sheds and maybe where you're finding concentrations of sheds at? Is that going like a playing in huge to where you're going to put these mineral sites or potentially hang a trail camera? Or are you just kind of using that as like more of an inventory type, like this buck lives here and he's still alive?
Well, you know, number one, I'm going to target the specific deer I'm targeting. I'm going to spend the most time looking for those antlers. So I'm in there learning while I'm learning about that deer and where he lives, I'm also usually looking for his antlers and then any other deer that live within his core area, which are usually the smaller deer that the satellite bucks, you could say, or whatever you want to call them. And so that's kind of how I do that. And then I'll know like where my target bucks live on, you know, those areas. I know those like the back of my hand. And it, with my eyes closed, I have learned them to the point, because this is not the first year I knew about them. I didn't just come into this year and go, okay, like I've built that history. And what I will do is once I feel comfortable that I know that area well, and I'm either found or not found in his sheds, I will take, you know, exploratory trips to other parts, either the farm or public land specifically. And I will walk. And then there I'm looking for more of that community type sign where I can, you know, hang cameras. And what I, you know, the whole point of this for me is I'm watching deer now that are 2 and 3 years old that I know have the potential to be something I want to do. And if they make it, you know, I'm keeping those deer in the back of my mind, keeping records of those. And then, you know, in 2 or 3, I'm keeping tabs on them as well. I'm not hunting them, but I need to know what's there. So I always have plan A, B, C, D, E, F, and it goes on and on and on. And you will get surprised. It will happen. I don't like getting surprised. There are situations like you want to out of state hunt. That's when you're expecting to be surprised, and that makes you feel good, but that's what you're there for. Mm-hmm. When I'm at home, I get one buck tag in the state of Kentucky, which is where I live. I am that buck tag is going to be used intentionally.
Right. Which goes into play on why you did not kill a deer in your home state, yes, of Kentucky this past, mm-hmm, year. So we kind of talked about it a little bit last year when we had you on, but you were chasing, there was, I don't know, 2 or 3 good bucks that you were chasing. Tell me about the experiences that you had, maybe what you learned last year, and some of the experiences that you had trying to actually chase after these specific deer that I believe were mostly on public land.
Yes. So it just so happened too that the deer that I ran into last year was on public land instead of private land. And that deer captivated me and took my attention. Well, it was a sheer accident that I found that deer. It was not intentional. It's just like, oh my gosh, there's a deer that I really need to pay attention to. And so then it was, okay, I'm going into hunting a mature deer that I have no history with. You know, how am I going to approach this? And, you know, I talked to some people that I trust, got some opinions on how I wanted to play it out. I knew where he was summering because I obviously ran into him, put my cameras up, got pictures of him right away, knew exactly what I had, and then I was figuring it out. Well, I was also targeting a different deer that was pretty, they were pretty similar. They're both, you know, which that deer ended up getting shot 2 weeks after I missed the deer in November. And so he was probably in the 180s. So anyways,
he got shot by a non-resident too, correct?
Yeah. And at least it wasn't somebody from Alabama.
Well, but, you know, at least.
So anyways, you know, I went into that last year, like, okay, I'm learning. I knew I had history with one deer, learning another deer. I had options. At least it's always good to have options, you know, at least 2 or 3 deer that you feel comfortable chasing. And so I went into last year, one deer I knew some stuff about, one deer I didn't. And so knowing he's going to shift, knowing where he's summering, ran cameras in there. I put him in there in July. I took 8 or 10 cameras in there with me and I let him soak. And that was just, you know, to kind of see him, learn what I could. When I went in there and discovered that, hey, I found this deer in July accidentally, that I need to know everything I can about this specific area because I'm going to attempt to hunt him, you know, when season comes in. But you know how it is, you only get 4 or 5 days the really good hunting before it transitioned into October and they really go nocturnal, and it's difficult to stay on those deer before they completely change patterns. So you know you have a window. And then I'm laying out and I literally walked, I sectioned it off, and I was walking and learning areas north, south, east, and west of where that deer summered with the plan that that deer is going to transition on me, and I need to be ready. So when he does, so I'm not behind and losing 2 or 3 weeks trying to relocate him. And so that alone, one, that takes some time and some cameras and some effort to do those things. And going into that, I was looking for traditional sign or previous year sign where he might have left it and then no, and you know, shown me where he was going to be. Now, that was more difficult to do than I thought. It actually took me longer than I thought, but I was able to get on that deer, had three different encounters with him. It never happened. I had him once within 100 yards, and he winded me when I was in a bottom wind swirl, and of course, and
so tell
that
me
one, that one got me there.
You talk about the shift, and most seasoned deer hunters know exactly what you're talking about, especially guys who are hunting states like Kentucky, Georgia even has that opportunity to kill a deer before they shift into more of a fall type pattern. Alabama doesn't get that nearly as much. We pretty much start our season in a fall pattern. But y'all have the opportunity to do that. But you talk about this shift, and I'm interested to know, in your experience, where these deer are spending time during the summertime. How far away are you typically finding them moving? If you had to have like an average distance from, let's say, from beginning of September to October range, where like right when that shift happens, how far are you finding that they move, and what are you doing to learn to try to get back on these deer?
So that was a major question I had that I asked everybody I could think of. In your experience, what do you expect going into it? And the, you know, it's going to vary by deer, which is hard because, you know, people don't get it. Deer are not textbook. They are like people. Mm-hmm. Every person has their own personality. You and I like different drinks, different food, different things. You know, I like to travel and go. Some people like to sit at home, and deer are the same way. But when you're trying to define them in a box, the best answer I can give is a 1 to 2 mile range on transition between summer and fall. And that is why a lot of times, even if you're hunting a 200-300-400 acre private farm, if you're not centered on that deer's core, he's going to be, you know, you may get him every summer and then he may be gone. And then, hey, you know, the deer that's sitting right here behind me, the one in the middle, he was a deer that did not live on us except in the summertime, 3 years in a row, summer, summer, summer. And he would come back, peak rut. And those trail cameras showed that to me 3 years in a row, peak rut. He would make that. And a lot of times, which you've heard it before from a lot of these guys who've really studied, a lot of times they will come back right before the rut really kicks in and rerun their summer range looking for that first doe. And I have picture proof of that deer doing that right there. And then the following year, I had that in mind. And I got lucky because he did hang around, and I think he got with a doe and hung around longer than normal because I checked that camera. He'd been there for 2 or 3 days before I climbed up in that stand. I was kicking myself for not being there sooner because I thought I had missed that window and he was going to go back. And the second set for that deer, he'd come out chasing doe. So I guess he just became either one of two things, either that he was the dominant deer that year because he got bigger, or the other deer, whatever happened, and he stayed there because there were more does and he liked it. But I really think what happened is he just got there, got with the doe and never left. But that deer there, no October, no September. When he would shed that velvet, gone. And there are deer on this public land that I will see. It's funny because I go back through pictures and I'll look and I'll say, like, you look at velvet and you're like, that deer and velvet, you know, I'll run through the list. Well, I don't have pictures of any of these deer anymore outside of velvet. And then there are deer that showed up hard horn. And it's like, I followed these deer from hard horn through January. And then I don't expect them to be, you know, I'm going to put cameras out unless I'm going to go searching for those deer. But the only time I typically do that is, you know, when I'm targeting those specific deer. And then I will, you know, if I know where he winters, I'll do my best to figure out where he summers to complete this puzzle. And if I have to put cameras out as far as I can, any given direction, and that goes for private or public, you know, anyway, as far as you can go is when you can go. That deer I was just, you know, referencing, he would only be on one camera ever. That deer did not live on us. I knew if I was going to kill him, it was one stand only in the back corner of that farm. And that farm is a great example because it's long and skinny. And I would have different bucks at the front, middle and back, and I was just catching, you know, it's like an overlapping diagram, or I think those called Venn diagrams, where they overlap.
Yeah, Venn
and
diagram.
That's just different. If you drew five circles and you overlapped each corner, those are different deer's home ranges. Mm-hmm. And depending on which one you're trying to target, that's what you're getting. And so you have to figure out, and if you can't go you know, half that circle's across the line, well, then you need to figure out how you're going to approach your half of that circle, when and where, and whether to stay out, go in, hunt hard, or however you want to go about it, is something you have to decide when it comes down to your deer on how well you know that specific animal.
So that's so good. I know you hunt several different places, several different areas, different types of terrain, some areas that have crops, some areas that don't. Do you find that deer in like a big woods type situation travel further or maybe not as far as deer that live in a more of a farm country ag land?
Oh yeah. There's no doubt. So, you know, you got, it all really revolves around the food. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just the math of it. Big woods do not provide the same type of nutrition as a crop. So a deer that can survive on a 20, 40, 60 acres, if he chooses on croplands, good, that has a mixture on a farm that's been set up, you know, by a hunter that wants it to be just for deer, and they, to where those deer don't have to leave if they don't choose, mm-hmm. you know, that deer can stay on 60 acres where in big mature hardwoods, you know, big woods, like you would find, you know, in here in certain places and in the Northeast, those deer have no choice. If you ask me, they've got to come up with the food they need. And so therefore they are going to travel. And plus, I think a lot of it deals with these tracts of land. It's funny to me. I watch some of these farms and some, especially when you can build history. That's why it's so neat to me to watch. There's one farm I've hunted for 5 or 6 years now. It's a permission farm, and it's got a big ravine in the middle. So I got crop field on one side, and probably 100 acres of woods in the middle, and it's a big creek. I mean, I'm talking steep up and down, and then crop field on this side. And it has, if you notice the bucks from front to back, it's a different. That creek seems to be a, generally speaking, a divider. Hmm. Between herds, and the deer on this side and the deer on that side are different. Now there is overlap. I have got front to back, but I have a salt lick on one back, one on the back, and one salt lick on the front. Different bucks in the summer, and then okay, I have a scrape limb that I traditionally put a camera on in front, and traditionally on the back, and it's always different deer.
Huh. That's wild.
So there are, so even in big wood settings, they can run further in my opinion in big wood settings because there are less boundaries. There are less, either be it man-made or natural. You know, if there's a big creek or a ravine or a road or a clear cut, an edge, something to define them. But if they're in mature hardwoods forever, the big woods, they can just be nomadic. Mm-hmm. They, you know, there's nothing to really define them. If you watch some, you know, some of these suburban hunting, you know, they're defined by their options.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there might be an interstate on this side, and that's a major barrier. And so you can eliminate that half because you can't hunt that half, or maybe he's not going to go over there. And the interstate is going to be, you know, you're going to get the deer on this side and then the deer on the other side. So they will travel farther and more often in those settings. And from my experience when they have to, and then of course, if you're on a, you know, prime crop mixture of woods with some cut over and some, you know, mature mass producing trees, there's a wide, you know, those deer don't have to do as much if they don't want to.
I remember talking to you this fall, and there was one specific deer that you were hunting hard. I think you were in Iowa at one point, and you were in Iowa, I think, when me and Hunter FaceTimed you. You're sitting up in a tree in Iowa, and there was a spike coming underneath you or something like that. And you said, hey, so-and-so deer daylighted. I think I might come home early and try to hunt him. And that was wild to me, considering you're hunting in Iowa at the time, you know, and you're like in the land of the giants. You drew your Iowa tag that year, and you're like doing the dream thing, but you knew that once this deer daylighted during the fall, that was the time to go after him. How often does that happen where, you know, you're running a ton of trail cameras even throughout the season? How often does it happen for you when it's like, oh crap, this deer's out in the daylight, I need to go? Is that a pretty regular occurrence, or do they still stay? My question really revolves around, are you finding that they're staying nocturnal even during that rut, all the phases of the rut?
I'm trying to figure out how to answer this the best. So that data is usually based on annual camera history. That's what I'm typically predicting my when and where I'm going to be hunting. And that takes years to build on when you expect to be where. Now, Iowa, for me, I drew that last year. I drew, you know, it took four points in my pocket. So the fifth year applying when I pulled. So a lot of good people ask me about that. And I did a full podcast with Exodus Trocam Radio on my Iowa experience. So if you want to know about that, that's there. And that was specifically about when and what I did. But that was 100% public land. I went up there in May, in July, and then October running cameras in Iowa also on the public land that I specifically intended to hunt with a couple smaller. I had one big piece and a couple smaller outliers that I had scouted, found spots, planned on running. And what happened there is first morning, October 24th, we had a really cold snap come through that week, if you remember. I was up there. I ran up there for the cold snap. I ran up there for that and hunted 3 days. And that was to finalize checking my cameras, moving them to where I wanted them to be during the rut, and then seeing the sign that had been presented while I was gone and created while I was gone. So when I got back peak November, I knew right where I was going to go. And I knew exactly what tree I wanted to be in when I came back, and it was on. And so that was the plan there. I passed a 140 some odd inch mature Iowa deer with a bow at like 8 yards on the very first morning. Well, it was the very first morning, and I don't regret it. I could have shot that deer. He'd have blended in with some deer on the wall, whatnot. It wasn't what I went to Iowa for. What I did not know at that time is the particular public land piece that I was attempting to hunt didn't have the caliber of deer I was hoping for. And there was, I think I had one 150 on that public piece that season. I actually did shoot one in January. I never did find it. Not many people know that, and that's just kind of whatever. I went back late season hunting, and that deer was probably, I don't know. I don't really know. I never got a great look. He had five on one side, that's all I know. But that was my intention there. I waited that long. I was, and just like, actually, I did this in both Kentucky and Iowa last year. I was prepared to eat my tags, which I said that and then it happened. I was prepared to eat my tags for something that meant something to me. And in Iowa, passing that 140, if I'd shot that deer that first morning, I would have thought one of two things. One, Iowa was the greatest place in the world. I shot the first morning and there was no telling, you know, what was that, you know, and I had to get back up there. But two, that deer was 140. I've been lucky enough to harvest some deer that size and bigger, to where that deer would have just, you know, it would have made me happy, but that's not what I held out for. It's not one up there. It's not what I waited 5 years for.
It's not the experience that you were looking to achieve.
Right. Yeah.
I went on as a guest on a podcast last night, the Paddle and Fin podcast. And we talked a lot about that, about like, you know, setting goals for yourself and following through with those goals. Those goals may be, hey, I want to shoot my first buck on public land, and you shoot your first spike you see on public land. You know, whatever it might be, set those goals for yourself and try to up them every year. You know, at one point in your life, you'd have been tickled to death to shoot a 140. You know,
100%.
You know, and that's the evolution, the progression, I guess, of your own deer hunting. So I know you're not saying that with the intention of like, of like down in a 140 for anybody.
No, that's a
great deer, but it's not what you wanted out of that. And that makes perfect sense. There's nothing wrong with that.
I went there with the intention of, you know, I don't know what was in my mind. I needed something to make me happy. And I did see another deer. I still think the deer was either 3 or 4. He was a 10. That was high 40s, low 50s. Came chasing a doe by me, and I mean wide open. Never could get a shot at him. I screamed and screamed trying to get that deer to stop, and he didn't. But Iowa was Iowa. Those deer acted like, you know, you can hunt public land, and I've hunted public land in 2 or 3 states where they're skittish, they're hard to find. They don't act like deer. To be fair, the Iowa deer acted like deer. The sign was, you know, they acted like private land deer for the most part. The sign where you'd set, I mean, everything you knew about deer hunting, if you knew anything at all, they behave like deer, and you could go in there and see 10, 15, 20 deer a set, and it was good. It was quality. I just didn't see the age class that I was hoping for to bring home on that particular, you know, piece and trip. And a lot of that I hunted up there a fair amount. I am completely satisfied with my experience and the money that I spent to go do that. I did sacrifice some time, some peak time up there to hunt this deer here in Kentucky because it was, it meant as much to me to kill the Kentucky deer. And that's what happened. You know, if you want to say, I passed the deer in Iowa, that was 140s. And then I passed the deer in Kentucky that was mature also. So I passed two. So to me, I didn't kill anything this year, last year. The year before I did kill 3 bucks. So it's not like I didn't. I could have had a great season by many standards by putting something on the ground. I could have killed two mature deer, one in Kentucky, one in Iowa. I opted not to. I didn't kill anything because I had specific goals, and that's what meant important to me. That's what was most important to me. And so I let a deer even bigger in Kentucky go, a fully, a mature 150 some odd inch, 10 points.
He was huge. I think there's a video of those
videos are on my, both of those videos are on my Instagram. I videoed both those deer. That was not what I was there for. And I knew based off of what I, one, a surprise deer in Iowa, and two, history in Kentucky, two completely different types of hunts. I knew coming in, when I got my look at them, that's not what I was there for.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know there's kind of going back to that experience and that conversation that we had about, hey, so-and-so deer daylighted, I'm coming home, I'm going to chase after him. Is that like something that, obviously that's a huge advantage of using a camera because you're not just going up in blind setting. I don't do it at all. Like for me, I love the element of surprise. Like it's a blast to me. I love being surprised by it. I hunt out of state quite a bit. I don't have a lot of cameras, and I know if I did what you did, I would become fixated on one thing and it wouldn't be as enjoyable for me. It's obviously super enjoyable for you. You love that aspect of it.
Well, and that's what makes hunting so great. There are so many different ways to be successful. Mm-hmm. And there's so many different ways. You can talk to so many people and there's no defined box. Mm-hmm. It's not a box. This can be done so many different ways, public, private, gun, bow, crossbow, whatever you want to do. There are so many different ways to be successful and still enjoy it and do it your way. What I do is not for everybody. But that is how I get the most enjoyment out of it, is by, fixating on that one deer, and that's just what I get. So I'll go back to the, the deer that daylighted. I had X amount of days. I wanted to be in Iowa, and then I was, all in the back of my mind, I was thinking about Kentucky, Iowa, deer there. You're never going to make the right decision, no matter when. You can plan to be there, and actually, what called me home was work. What called me home was work, and I had no choice but to get back here. I left Iowa a few days early, came home. I think that day I drove all through the night and was in the stand that next morning in Kentucky, checked it, knew where I wanted to be, climbed in that stand, and he had been there the morning before, the day before that, I don't remember. And that was when, I knew that I was right where I needed to be. I just had to be there. And then I followed it up, and I don't remember how it all worked laid out. I had to think back, but it was right in there. That same set is where I missed that deer.
Where did
I hit a limb.
So normally you're talking about, you're obviously having to stay pretty mobile with the use of using your trail cameras. And, if one happens to show up like that, I would imagine you don't have a stand, lock-on stand or something hung up at every trail cam site. What are you doing as far as that's concerned? What's your system like for actually getting up in a tree?
So I converted and I went full saddle last year. I ran the tethered saddle get up the whole bit. And then the sticks, I ran the Novix Mini. The Novix Minis, they were the alternating singles, which for the money, those sticks there actually, very, very pleased for the year that I ran with him, but I will be buying some double steps before this year's over.
Yeah.
Before the summer's over. And before that is one thing I will be doing.
So have you found that, that has helped you with, as far as maintaining this style of hunting and always staying mobile? Has the saddle been a pretty big benefit for that?
Yeah, I mean, I won't go back, especially as long as I continue to hunt the way I do. Now, we have everything. We do have some rednecks. We have some buddy stands. We have ladder stands. We have lock-on stands. They're on the private land farms, but those are not for me anymore. That's for my kids, my wife, my grandpa. guests, you know, those, that's what those are there for. And even like when I hunt with my wife, we have options because like we go climb in a single man ladder stand. I'll just put my platform and get up above her and then sit in the saddle because I just hunt with her. And so when I, so we have options, but for doing the way I do and staying mobile, after converting last year, it will be what I do from here on. You know, obviously you can never tweak it enough on what kind of, you know, what you want to run and what you want to do and buy. And, so I'm still, you know, first year I had a good experience with it, and, I'll get off on a tangent here real fast. I had my platform and sticks were stolen out of the bed of my truck. I'm still not 100% sure when, but I actually caught the guy selling them on Facebook. And
did you get them back?
I did. I had actually already ordered the exact same setup. The saddle was in my tote, so it was in my truck, but my backpack with my sticks strapped to it was in the bed of the truck because, you know, it's just bigger and bulkier and it's got the sharp edges on it. So I just threw it in the bed of the truck, and I don't know when or how, and who knows, maybe even I left it laying on the side of the road. I don't know, but either way they end up getting stolen. And, you know, a friend of mine sent me who also saddle hunted, so he knew what they were. I had told him what happened. I said, you know, keep on the lookout. And sure enough, it was 3 days later. I had, you know, he sent them to me. He sent me the screenshot. Hey, these sticks right here, hey, look, this is a good deal. And I was like, yeah, because they're mine. But that's them.
Because the guy and didn't pay anything for them.
Yeah. So I called him out, and he ended up, long story short, he gave them back. It was wild. He never actually claimed to steal them. He actually told me, he actually attempted to help me find them. And then I found them on a tree. He found them on a tree on public land and then told me where they were.
Huh.
So he never actually admitted to stealing them, but he told me where some stuff that looked exactly like mine, he just happened to run across in the woods was. So I never, yeah, I think he was just worried I was going to turn him in.
Yeah. Yeah.
But,
so
yeah, wild.
Obviously, I mean, we talk quite a bit about saddle hunting and on this podcast, and it has great, huge benefits for, especially for a guy that is trying to remain mobile. While my hunting style and your hunting style are a little bit different, they both definitely fall under the same category of mobile hunting, and so I think that's good for people to hear that you can have. There's several ways to skin a cat, you know. Like,
oh, yeah.
you can do it a whole bunch of different ways. So you talked a little bit about putting cameras on mineral licks, things like that. Let's just give a thought of not having that. So you don't have the ability to put a mineral out on a piece of public. In Alabama, you can't do that at all. What's your go-to? You mentioned scrapes. Are you running cameras on scrapes? Is that like right now? Like you're finding older scrapes and like licking branches and stuff like that?
So what I did / the way I approach it. So I'm in this postseason scouting shed hunting. I mark, I know how many cameras I have and how many I want to allocate to said piece of property. And I mark those spots. So when I'm out there scouting, I mark everything. I use Onyx. I use everything. It's like, all right, scrape, you know, trail, anything relevant that I think I would want to know. I've got a pin there. You look at mine, it's just dots everywhere. Most people just freak out when they see it, but you know, there's just dots everywhere. And so and then at the end of the winter, as we're going into spring, before I switch to turkeys and while my mind is still on, I sit down on my computer and I determine where those cameras are going to be before next season even starts. So I know, or while I'm there, if it's that good of a spot and I've looked and I have found it and I know, I'm going to mark it right then. And when I pull all my cameras in, everything's color coordinated. So like when I go out this spring, I started yesterday was day one, and we started going out there. It was like, I don't have to walk out there and wonder. I don't have to waste time in the, when it's hot and covering ticks. I walk out there, I go straight to that pen, and I do sometimes have a hard time with myself. Why am I standing where I'm standing? But I always trust myself. Like I marked this for a reason. Like I, you know, I know I have X amount of cameras. Everybody does. They have X amount of time, X amount of resources. But I put this here when it was on my mind and when the sign was the most fresh for a reason. And so I will follow through and I will put cameras at everywhere I have marked. And traditionally summertime, scrapes. I mean, that to me is your version of a mineral lick. That's where you're going to get the most deer. That's where you're going to get, you know, and to be fair, you got to remember these deer may not be there when those scrapes are getting worked. They may be gone, but to figure out what's in there right now, that is still, and you can listen to all sorts of these guys that have talked about the you know, you can get way deep in the scrape rabbit hole.
Yeah.
But you know, those community scrapes, and you've got to know the difference. You've got to spend the time, be in the woods enough to learn the difference in a November scrape and the community scrape. There are, because those, like even today, we spent camera time this morning putting out cameras. There was, you know, there were spots I went to, it was like obvious limbs broke, leaves are dead, or didn't go leaves this year. It's like, hey, that's the licking branch. That's the portion of this I want to focus on. And there's other spots where I walked out and it's like, and it was just like I said, why am I here? I have a scrape mark, but I don't see it. And then I'm worried, is this really somewhere I should put a camera? But it's like I said, I always, it's even today, I question myself, but I still put the camera there. And, you know, I marked it for a reason when the sign was the most fresh. And so the other thing I will focus on is any kind of terrain or feature that will pinch those deer down and create that trail. Mm-hmm. And those are still, most defined in the late winter, early spring. When you're after shed hunting, it's usually wet, muddy. You know, they've had a full fall worth of activity. And so those, especially where two major trails cross, I have many X's. I have them it's labeled as trails X. And where those trails X, you know, you're getting a 2-for-1. You don't have to, and that can be as good as a scrape. So if there's a tree's falling down, there's a big root wad, or if there's a road, or if there's a creek, there's some reason to force those deer around the head of, you know, deer are lazy, or you can consider them efficient, whatever you want to call it. They're going to take the path of least resistance because, as all wild animals do, it's survival to them. So they are going to take what's given to them. But if that means walking around instead of going through, that's what they'll do. Mm-hmm. And you know, or if that means jumping this log because it's thicker over here, that's what they'll do. You figure those things out, you notice those things, and you figure out how to get those cameras where you can maximize your resource, your camera. And so that is what, you know, I always try to do, is try to figure out where that pinch is. And that's why, especially in the summertime, you know, November is a little more obvious. They're a little more, the leaves are off, you can see farther, you know, they're hitting other scrapes. But to really be efficient in the summertime with your cameras, you got to have that insight, that information ahead of time. Mm-hmm. Now there are areas I'll go into in the summer, and typically you just don't do as well because your information is not as good. Mm-hmm. You're guessing as much as anything. You can find in November, you might walk right past it because there are areas, even today, I walked in there and like I said, I'm like, this looks nothing like it did in February. Like, I don't even know why I would be here. Like it's so green. Everything's changed. You know, leaves have fallen, moved, whatever. It's been 3 or 4 months. And so I always set my stuff ahead of time. And I know, and maybe that's just my system. That's just what I know. And then same thing, like I'll sit down and make a list at the private land farms we do. Okay, I need X amount of cameras for this because there's X amount of mineral licks. Or I'm going to create a mineral lick, take away one. This didn't produce for me last year, so I'm not going to put one here. And then going back to that, to the public version of this, or just the place you can't do mineral, if you can find where the trails X, don't, you know, the mock scrape, you know, don't, if you can give them one more reason to be in the frame of your camera.
Yeah.
You know, even if it, and sometimes, you know, I don't get too serious with that, but I have attempted it, and there are occasions where it has worked, and there are occasions when it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. But if you can up your odds, even the slightest, to get that deer in frame, to know he's there and get that information. Because if he's walking away on a trail and he's moving and it's blurry and you can't tell what it is, then you just, you know, what good does that do? But if you get him to hesitate just a second to go check out what he thinks might be a real scrape, that might be the difference in knowing and not knowing what deer that was, or whether it's worth your time to pull cameras, move cameras over there, spend more energy, more time over there. You know, that can be huge.
So I know from talking to you in the past that your cameras will range from right next to the road to miles away from the road. Like, it's just kind of, you don't really have any type of, you know, have any type of, like, I'm only going to hang cameras if I'm 500 yards away from a road system. It just, because that's not what you're, not necessarily using them for, to find the spot that you're going to hunt, especially not this time of year. And once pressure changes and all that kind of stuff, it's going to manipulate where the deer are moving at, for sure. We know that as mm-hmm. hunters, that's, pressure is maybe the number one factor of changing how they pattern. In when you have a high pressure area, that's going to be a big deal. So with the guy who's running a lot of cameras, I'm interested to know what kind of changes you see happening, whether it be nocturnal or daylight. What kind of changes do you see happening once the season opens up and once there's hunters in and out driving the roads consistently? Do you notice that affecting a whole lot on your cameras?
Yeah. Those deer are way less patternable, way less consistent. They're going to be more random. I mean, and there's so many outlying factors. You know, I experienced this on public land last year between the squirrel hunters, the mushroom hunters, the butterfly catchers, the dog walkers,
the Alabama hunters.
You just don't ever know. You know, there was a guy, Iowa was awful. There was people, you know, it was like November, it was peak rut, and you know their season doesn't come into late. Guy's coming through to check a camera. I'm sitting there bow hunting. He just walks right past me, and you know, it was funny because he walked past that big deer that I was talking about. I couldn't get to stop, come chasing that doe by me. It was like 11:30 in the morning. Come chasing that doe right by me, and then 10 minutes later, here he comes right back. So that doesn't, you know, the people, especially during the rut, don't let that discourage you, because it's interesting. And it's funny to see how many people I get on camera and I'm like, people, deer, people, or, you know, but yeah, there are, I have cameras and I run them a mile, two deep. And then I have cameras that are right next to the road. I mean, right next to the road, it'd blow your mind. And, a lot of that is me trying to get inventory. I mean, deer have to cross roads. They have no choice in some cases. Now, not always, but some cases they have to cross roads to survive. That's just part of what they have to do. Well, a lot of times at roads, they only cross in certain – they cross in a certain spot because of the features that allow that. Because mm-hmm. and that can be as much of a pinch point as anything. If there's a gully and a ridge or a bridge, or maybe two roads collide and they want to go around those, or two roads meet, there's so many different options. So – yeah, then I'm not scared to put a camera anywhere. I've got one, and like I said, even in the summertime, I do like, you know, I like to do neat things. I've got one on a pond right now with that setup, trying to get banded wood ducks, because there's traditionally they band locally, so they're there. And then I've got three in a barn, where deer bed in barns. I've gotten several really neat sets in barns. Anywhere I see a deer or anything unusual, especially in the summertime, I mean, it's very neat. It's cool to me. It's what I like to do. And so I put those cameras on video and put them in those crazy places. You know, I've had deer bed underneath a camper. I've seen that. So I've got pictures of deer bedded under a camper in a barn. You know, I've got pictures of a vehicle going by and then a big buck standing on the side of the road waiting to cross right next to it. You know, 150. I mean, just, and you can do frame by frame. You can do deer, vehicle. I mean, it's just so there's a lot of places that people overlook, and that's when you can get, when you have a lot of cameras, you finally get to that ability. And don't think, you know, cameras are, a lot of these, I'm running some cheap cameras. I mean, I have to be, mm-hmm. and I've got some expensive cameras and I've got some cheap cameras. And last year I only had one cell cam. This year is the first year I've actually gotten a few more. And so I don't, that doesn't entice me too much. I'll have a few just to try. I'm slow to that style. We'll give it a go. And a lot of those will be out of state where I'm not there. Mm-hmm. They're really neat tools, and you can learn so much from them, and I'm addicted to them. And that's like, you look at my page, that's all I post, because that's all I care about anymore. It's like, I mean, just getting, you know, creating these setups and getting neat pictures and big deer at that. It fascinates me.
Now your claim to fame is Trail Cam Tuesday, is that correct? Like, that's your,
yeah, that,
you
that,
came
yeah,
up
that
with
is,
the
that is correct
hashtag.
So back in the good old days when I was in college, I had a LLC where we would actually run social media for outdoor companies, and you know, we were big into, you know, all the taking pictures and posting and doing all that back before it got to be overly saturated and beat to death back when it was, you know, in its infancy. And then, yeah, you know, then got out of school and sold it and moved on and just kind of do it for me now.
And do you happen to know off the top of your head how many times that hashtag Trail Cam Tuesday has been
I have not. I don't even know. I know it gets passed around quite frequently, but back when that was started, back when I claimed that, and that may not have been the, you know, I hate to say I'll be the very first one, but I was at the very tip. I was very close to it. If I wasn't the one that started, I was definitely the one that promoted it the most and took its level. So I'll at least take that. I won't take the,
yeah,
you know, maybe the entirety of it, but I definitely pushed it and got, but that was so long ago. That was on Twitter. So that was that was created there.
Oh, wow.
Like Instagram at that time was not the thing to do. If you, you know, but that was back when you could, you know, post song lyrics as your status on Facebook, you know, before it got taken over by the rest. So that's how long ago that was.
So I have here, is it hashtag Trail Cam Tuesday?
Mm-hmm.
Is that it? I have about 50,000 posts is what shows up on
not
here.
Terrible. Not terrible. So, I posted actually, and this is rare. I'm pretty strict with myself. I don't feel like I miss a lot, but I was at the farm yesterday. We started on a lease and got going there and putting some cameras up on those salt licks. And I forgot a camera. That's rare for me. I left the camera up over I typically take them down in February, March after the antlers fall and then, you know, bring them back in. And then I don't put them up till, you know, July 4th is what I shoot for. But when I've got this many now, I got to get started.
Yeah.
And so I tried to shoot for around that July 4th, but I actually missed one. And so it actually had some cool videos, and I posted that last night. I had a coyote howling on video.
That's cool.
And so that was a first for me, actually. But yeah, I've gotten some really neat stuff throughout the one I've actually waiting. I'm waiting to, you know, on another good day to post it. But I've got a black snake in my barn and a mockingbird chasing it.
Huh.
Like trying to, you know, I guess was going for the nest, which I put it in there for deer. But, you know, sometimes you get some really cool byproduct.
Well, you posted a picture the other day, and it may, here it is, this picture right there, the two bucks.
Throwback.
$2 in that barn next to that old truck. I mean, that's just
that's
cool.
That's the original one. That's the original one. That's what kind of, you know, back, that was when I was, I don't know if I remember, I think I was in college. I might have been in high school. I'm not sure which, but that started it, and all that was just an old barn on a lease we once had. We don't have that anymore. Farm's been sold, but that barn, I just drove up there one day, and that deer jumped up out of there, and I was like, hey, I'll put a camera in here.
Yeah,
and you know, and it stemmed from that. I've got a bunch of, you know, that picture that I posted is my favorite of them. But I've got videos. I mean, while I had the camera in there, while they were using it, I put two or three cameras in there. I did videos, pictures from different angles, and did all kinds of, and tried different things just to see if I could, you know, how good I could make it, and come up with different things. Because I mean, at that point, like I said, at that point in time of the year, I wasn't as focused on where that deer would be during the rut and all that stuff. So I had cameras available. But yep, they're, like I said, I use a wide variety and I have nicer cameras and I have cheaper cameras. And I you know, you put in, and that's another thing I didn't touch on here, but at least not right yet. But, you know, I rank those cameras in my mind. It's like, all right, well, I know that I paid this much for this one and I know I paid this much for this one. So my ones that are cheaper, you know, I'm going to put in places that are riskier. And then I'm going to take my high dollar ones and they're probably going to the private land or they're going to somewhere I feel safe, or I'm going to put them up high. I'm going to lock them. I'm going to, you know, put it somewhere creative where it's not as obvious. And so you got to do those things. And that's just a comfort level. I mean, running that many, I had five cameras stolen last year. And I had, separately from that, I had at least five SD cards stolen.
Hmm.
So, but you know, for as many as I was running, you know, that's still, you know, 5 to 10%, we'll say. So it's not a terrible rate. I really was unsure as to what it would be like, but there's definitely are some of those people out there.
Well, you know, you've really hit on a lot of the benefits of using a trail camera. A lot of reason people don't use them is for fear of it's just a waste of money, especially on public land. they're going to get stolen, blah, 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 blah. I don't use them for other reasons. It doesn't have anything to do with that as much as it is. It's not necessarily my hunting style. That's not to say that I won't ever do it. And to be honest with you, I'd probably buy 100 of them right now if I had the money to do it. It's just not right now in my means, I guess, to do it. But
sure.
There's hearing you talk, for somebody who is really wanting to learn how to get the most out of their trail cameras, I can't think of a whole lot of people that would be better to talk to than yourself. And hearing, you know, how much it goes into play for you throughout the season, from right now until, I mean, the end of deer season, you know, it really does set you up for success in a lot of ways, sets you up for disappointment in some ways. And,
there was a day that I slept in, and guess what? Rolled in, checked the camera, should have been there.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, there are those heartbreaks, and then you'll go, and then the people, you know, there might be somebody on it. It might be stolen. You know, there's all sorts of, it might have malfunctioned. Oh my gosh. You know, the amount of, you might have left it on setup instead of on, man. You know, the amount of times I've done that, you know, where the batteries have gone dead. But, you know, like I said, I don't want people to think that I have just, you know, this collection of cameras is a group of friends in a lot of ways helping. This is me, you know, every time I try not to think about it. It's like, hey, 30, 40, 50, 60-yard camera, just buy one, not think about it. Every time you go to Walmart, just grab one, don't think about it. And eventually it'll add up. But, you know, I'm running cameras. It's funny. I was putting one together last night. The year on it was 2008. You know, when you first fired up, it goes to the default year that the software was put together. And I circled actually accidentally at the down button. Well, it only goes to 2030, and it's 2021. So if that camera's already made it from 08 to now, and if I make it to 30, I'm going to run out of years.
Yeah, you ain't going to have any years left.
So no, I mean, so like I said, this has been me. You know, I asked for these things for Christmas. I asked for every, you know, stocking stuffers, birthday presents. Like if this is what I enjoy, so this is what I spend, you know, where I'm could be going out or doing other things or vacation. This is just what I love to do.
Yeah.
So I don't want people thinking that I just went and, you know, spent $100 on about $300 cameras, which I had some nice, very expensive, nice cameras, you know, the Exodus cameras for, I'm going to spend the money on something I'm going to buy.
Yeah,
but I've got everything from Tascos to Wild Game Stealth Cam, Browning, Moultrie, you name it, I got it.
That's awesome, man. Well, I do appreciate you coming on and talking about a lot of this stuff, man. It's cool to hear you how this stuff has helped you, how trail cameras have really went into play and helped you in a lot of ways, and if nothing else, you know a whole lot about the deer in your area. And that's valuable information. If somebody took away all your trail cameras tomorrow, you would leave with enough intel to be able to continue to be a good deer hunter. And so the amount of intel that it gives you, without you, you know, while you're gone, while you're not there in the woods, for me, if I sleep in, I don't know what happened. You know, I'll never know what happened if I sleep in you know, right now, this time of year, I'm banking on the areas that have always panned out for me. I'm banking on those being good. I may get there next season and they may suck for whatever reason. There's so many factors that come into play, but I do appreciate you, Reese, coming on and sharing a little bit of your tactics and strategies.
Well, and I know we got to get off. I'm going to make two more quick points on that. Is one, the thing, and this, I didn't talk about this because it gets hit to death, but just like you said, you never know what's there. But when you know, one, you can always infer the weather, the data, why, when, what happened on that day. If you want to go back and look into that, that's up to you. And then the other thing is just like those traditional, like you were saying, you're never going to know. Well, let's say somebody did take away all my cameras. Well, I know a heck of a lot of saddles, pinch points, edges, you know, things that, and honestly, I anticipate that happening. There's no way I can continue to do this for the next 10, 20, 30 years. I cannot. My kids are getting older. I'm going to get to take them hunting. I, you know, work, my business is growing every day. I'm not going to be able to continue this trend, but hey, if I'm running no cameras, I know right where I can go set and have a very good traditional spot and not be off the X. They'll be right where that is from here on out. So, you know, even if you ran a camera out for only a few years and then you ended up taking that away or you weren't able to do it in the future, you can be on the X instead of off of it 5 years from now. And those traditional spots are typically going to be, all things the same, very good.
Yeah. That's awesome, man. That's some really good information. Tell people where they can follow along on this Trail Cam Tuesday stuff and any other platforms you might have.
So it's just Reese Johnson 7, and that's R-E-E-S-E on Instagram and Twitter. And then my Facebook page is Reese Johnson Land, and that's for my work. I'm a real estate broker licensed in Kentucky and Tennessee, and I do a lot of I sell a lot of hunting farms, houses and commercial too, but hunting farms. What I enjoy, obviously.
So you if you're listening and you're looking for a hunting farm, look for a nice piece of property, contact Reese. He'll get you set up. Is that right?
That'll work. That's right.
Awesome, man.
Well, happy to help.
I appreciate it, man. You have a good one, and I hope this season pans out better for you than last season did, and you get a couple of giants on the ground.
Well, fingers crossed. If I figure everybody'll know.
Well, if you come down to Alabama, there's a bunch of spikes waiting for you.
Bunch of spikes. Hey, I appreciate the shout out last week. Yeah, it is on my to-do list, but I've just got to tag out early, which never happens. But one day when I tag out early, Alabama in January will be on my list.
It'll be on spike patrol.
Yeah, they're going to brown it's down. It's happening.
Thank you all for listening to this week's episode of the Southern Ground Hunting Podcast. As always, a big shout out to all of our partners, Spartan Forge, Tethered, New Canoe, and Scree Gear. You can keep up with Southern Ground Hunting by following us on Facebook and Instagram or subscribing to the YouTube channel. And be sure to check out southerngroundhunting.com to pick up some of our merch. I truly hope you enjoyed this week's episode, and we'll see you here again next week. Remember that God gave you dominion over the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, and the beasts of the earth. So go out and exercise that dominion. We'll talk to you next time.